This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. The World Health Organization now says that the coronavirus variant first identified in India last year was being classified as a variant of global concern, with some preliminary studies showing that it spreads more easily. The B.1.617 variant is the fourth one to be designated or designated as a being of global concern and requiring heightened tracking and analysis. The others are those first detected in Britain, South Africa, and Brazil. The WHO has said that the predominant lineage was first identified in India in December, although an earlier version was spotted in October of 2020. The variant has already spread to other countries, and many nations have moved to cut or restrict movements from India. U.S. regulators on Monday expanded the use of Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine to children as young as 12, offering a way to protect the nation's adolescents before they head back to school in the fall and paving the way for them to return to more normal activities. Shots could begin as soon as Thursday after a federal vaccine advisory committee issues recommendations for using the two-dose vaccine in 12 to 15-year-olds. An announcement is expected Wednesday. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson Monday gave the green light to cautious hugging and the serving of pints inside pubs after months of strict restrictions as he set out the new phase of coronavirus lockdowns easing in England. Johnson confirmed that England could continue to the next stage of its four-step plan to bring the country out of lockdown by the summer as the COVID-19 situation improved thanks to the rollout of vaccines and social restriction measures. Under Step 3 from May 17th, people will be permitted to meet up indoors for the first time in months in groups of up to six people or two full households together. This is VOA News. The U.S. Pentagon announced Monday that a U.S. Coast Guard ship fired about 30 warning shots after 13 vessels from Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps Navy came close to it and other American Navy vessels in the Strait of Hormuz. This is the second time within the last month the U.S. military vessels have had to fire warning shots because of what they said was unsafe behavior by Iranian vessels in the region after a relative lull in such interactions over the past year. Pentagon spokesman John Kirby said the warning shots were fired after the Iranian fast boats came as close as 150 yards of six U.S. military vessels, including the USS Monterey, that were escorting the guided missile submarine Georgia. The U.S. Coast Guard cutter Maui fired the warning shots from a 50-caliber machine gun before the Iranian vessel left. In response to the rocket attacks from Hamas, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that Israel will respond very forcefully to them. Palestinian militants in the Gaza Strip fired the rockets toward the Jerusalem area and southern Israel on Monday, carrying out a threat to punish Israel for violent confrontations with Palestinians in Jerusalem. The Gaza Health Ministry said nine Palestinians, including three children, were killed in a series of strikes in northern Gaza. It did not explicitly blame Israel for the deaths in an area that has been staging grounds for militants' cross-border rocket attacks. Government auto safety investigators are looking into reports of steering failures in more than 100 older model Honda Accords. We get more from AP correspondent Jackie Quinn.
There have been dozens of complaints and two crashes involving 2013 through 2015 Honda Accord sedans. Owners have reported a loss of steering control and cars veering off the road in one case, slamming into a building. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration says it began an investigation after a petition submitted by an owner, which could eventually lead to a recall. Honda says it is cooperating, and any owner with a steering problem should take the car to a Honda dealership to see if repairs are needed. I'm Jackie Quinn.
A NASA spacecraft is headed back to Earth with rubble it collected from an asteroid nearly 200 million miles away. The robotic explorer OSIRIS-REx fired its engines Monday to start the two-year trip home. The spacecraft reached the ancient carbon-rich space rock in 2018 and spent 2 years flying near and around it. It gathered samples from the surface last October. The lead scientist for the mission estimates it holds as much as a pound of asteroid rubble. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
We'll be right back. welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, May 11th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Nigeria reimposes a nationwide curfew to control a surge in COVID-19 cases.
Generally, we are trying to mitigate the risk of contracting the increased transmission of COVID-19, considering what is happening globally and also the fear of importation of new cases, particularly the new variants, into the country.
COVID-19 variants first spotted in the United Kingdom and India are now circulating in South Africa. Four Zambian opposition parties form an alliance ahead of the August election. And Ugandan security forces restrict opposition movement ahead of President Museveni's inauguration this Wednesday.
It is important to note that security is given according to the weight of some people or status. And Honorable Kyagulanyi is one of the people who is lucky to be at a higher status in this country.
And a mining concern in Senegal's northern Lampung region. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Nigeria has reimposed a nationwide curfew to control a new surge in COVID-19 cases and its variants. It will begin at 1 a.m. Tuesday, May 11th to 4 a.m. every day. Phase 4, as it is called, restricts mass gatherings outside the workplace and a maximum of 50 people in an enclosed space. All approved gatherings must observe physical distancing measures. It imposes a 7-day quarantine for all international passengers and institutional quarantine for passengers arriving from India, Brazil, and Turkey. The new curfew does not restrict intrastate travels. Dr. Mukhtar Muhammad is head of technical secretariat of the Presidential Steering Committee on COVID-19.
Generally, we are trying to mitigate the risk of contracting the increased transmission of COVID-19, considering what is happening globally and also the fear of importation of new cases, particularly the new variants, into the country. We know that people have relaxed on these measures. The public is no longer observing the non-pharmaceutical interventions put in place, that is wearing of face masks, keeping social distancing, avoiding overcrowding, as well as using sanitizers or washing hands where necessary. Temperature checks in public places, complying to these measures when using public transportation or other public spaces as well. So these measures are just to make sure that people continue to observe them, particularly at this point in time where we are at the risk of having a third wave of COVID-19 in Nigeria.
The new restrictions, will they include intrastate travels?
No. There is no restriction on state travels. However, people traveling with commercial means, with public transportation, are enjoined to comply with the non-pharmaceutical interventions put in place.
This curfew is being reimposed because of a surge. So what part of the country is most impacted with this surge?
As we have seen in the last several months now, 5 states have been in the eye of the storm in terms of COVID-19 in Nigeria. These are Lagos State, FCT, Plateau, Kaduna, and Port Harcourt, that is River State. These states have been in the most in terms of numbers, they have been the most in terms of positivity rates, and they have fairly remained the same states.
I want to talk about COVID-19 vaccination. What percentage of Nigeria's population would you say has been vaccinated? And does the government provide this vaccine free of charge?
Yeah, certainly. Vaccines are free. Vaccines are provided free of charge to the population. We have obtained about 4 million doses of these vaccines. Right now, we have administered over 1 million doses of these vaccines. That is quite far from our target. This is just less than 1% of the population. And Nigeria is making more efforts to make sure that we acquire more vaccines so that we can continue the rollout.
It seems to me this new curfew is lax because people are going to be free to move around. How do you hope to control it?
Yeah, so, you know, when you have an epidemic or pandemic like this, the measures we are putting in place is to help mitigate the risk, to reduce the risk of transmission, to also reduce the impact, you know, of the pandemic itself. We know that we are not going to eliminate the risk completely, and therefore the measures that are being put in place now to ensure that the public, you know, comply with these rules The authorities at the federal government and state government have been encouraged to enforce these restrictions. We are talking about public gathering. Indoors gatherings that are more than 50 are not allowed. Places of worship, they are to maintain 50% capacity. Restaurants will provide takeaway services, but eat-in service should not also exceed 50%. People accessing public places must wear their face mask. If there is no face mask, service should not be provided. Temperature checks should be mounted in all public places. We've asked civil servants who are on grade level 12 and below to work from home or work virtually when necessary. For private businesses, we've also asked them to limit the number of people per space to what is acceptable on such gatherings. Political gatherings also have to comply with the COVID-19 measures put in place by INEC. So these are the measures, and that is what we hope to achieve.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you very much. You are welcome.
Dr. Mukhtar Muhammad is the head of technical secretariat of the Presidential Steering Committee on COVID-19. He was speaking with us from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. Scientists in South Africa say COVID-19 variants first detected in the United Kingdom and India are now circulating in the country and are likely to increase the severity of a third wave of the pandemic. South Africa has been hardest hit on the continent by COVID-19 with 1.6 million confirmed cases and almost 55,000 deaths. Now, as winter sets in, infections are once again surging. Darren Taylor has more.
Medical scientists say the variants first found in the UK and India are unlikely to replace the one detected in South Africa late last year as the dominant strains. But they're still concerned, particularly about the three variants driving infections in India. Progressive Health Forum leader Dr. Aslam Dasu explains that scientists are trying to determine if these mutations increase transmission and virulence.
The upsurge in India indicates that is indeed the case. You would not be able to find that kind of transmission with the original founder virus, shall we put it that way. And with the force of infection, certainly of the kind we're seeing, tragically seeing in India, the emergence of more variants is inevitable.
Preliminary investigations by local scientists indicate that the imported variants, simply put, aren't as bad as South Africa's, because they aren't as good at evading the immunity afforded by current vaccines. Nevertheless, say the medical minds, the fact that the mutations from the UK and India are now here can only add to the country's COVID-19 burden. South Africa's immunization drive is yet to begin in earnest, so Dasu urges citizens to maintain protective measures such as social distancing and wearing masks.
Look, we're not going to avoid a third wave. What we can do is determine the scale of that wave through the non-pharmaceutical interventions that we're all very familiar with. There's really nothing else that we have in our armory to protect people. And we do know that you can reduce the peak of a wave and the extent of a wave just by utilizing those methods. But the third wave is upon us.
The problem is, according to Health Minister Zweli Mkhize, many South Africans have become complacent. This is putting pressure on the government to once again enforce a strict lockdown and to, for example, ban social gatherings. This wouldn't be necessary, says Dasu, if the state had a better vaccination strategy.
In short, it's woefully inadequate.
The government was forced to delay its immunization program a few months ago. This after it was determined that the AstraZeneca shot, of which it had bought 1 million, wasn't very effective in preventing mild to moderate COVID-19 in people with a variant dominant in South Africa. But, says Dasu, this excuse has only limited validity.
After that, it was clear, because it was very effective against severe illness, hospitalization and death, it should have been administered to as many South Africans as possible. Instead, we sold it off.
Like other countries, South Africa also had to pause its rollout of the Johnson & Johnson jab because of concerns it caused blood clots.
It was an unfortunate decision again. We lost a couple of weeks. That has now resumed. But our total vaccination is under 350,000. And this is of great concern, especially if we are trying to reach millions. We don't have the supply, and security of supply is a huge problem in any vaccination program, given the conditions of this particular virus. So we're in a very difficult situation going into the third wave. It would have been ideal in the past.
Dasu describes U.S. President Joe Biden's recent support of waiving intellectual property rights for COVID-19 vaccines as huge. The doctor believes it could result in a flow of vaccines to less affluent countries that need it most, such as South Africa, and potentially save hundreds of thousands of lives, if not more. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Ugandan security forces have deployed heavily at the home of opposition leader Robert Chakulai, also known as Bobi Wine, ahead of tomorrow Wednesday's swearing-in ceremony of President Yoweri Museveni, who was declared the winner of the January 2021 disputed elections. Ugandan police spokesperson Fred Enanga said the opposition is planning to have a concurrent swearing-in ceremony of Bobi Wine, who still claims to have won the elections. Mugumi Davis Rakarinji has more from Kampala.
Kanodewa Kiki, Uganda People's Defense Forces, UPDF spokesman, confirmed at the Monday press conference that the army had deployed at opposition leader Robert Chagulani's home to bolster his security because he is, quote, a distinguished Ugandan.
I want to assure Ugandans that security is given to every Ugandan and it is given to the entire country. However, it is important to note that security is given according to the weight of some people or status. And Honorable Chagulani is one of the people who is lucky to be at a higher status in this country. We cannot have the same security deployment to the people of higher status and those of low status.
Chagulani posted on his social media pages criticizing the deployment of security forces around his home in Magele, an outskirt of the Ugandan capital, Kampala. The military and police have yet again surrounded my residence as the general prepares to illegally swear himself this Wednesday, Chagulani tweeted. He added, the situation is still tense. Dozens of soldiers surrounding my home checking every vehicle that comes in and goes out. Chagulani, common known as Bobi Wine and the president of the opposition party, National Platform, says he won the general election and vowed to organize peaceful protests to reclaim his victory. According to the Electoral Commission, Chagulani polled 35% votes against the incumbent President Museveni, who won 58%. Speaking at the same press conference, Fred Enanga, Uganda police spokesman, said the opposition is planning a parallel swearing-in ceremony of Chagulani. He said the organizers, as well as reporters, will attend will be charged with treason.
These are ceremonies which simply remain symbolic without any accompanying entitlements and privileges of a legitimate head of state. So, to a bigger extent, it's a wastage of time. Therefore, any judicial officer, organizers, media houses that will participate in covering the legitimate parallel swearing-in ceremony, let it be in Iganga or in any other places, should prepare to face the consequences, because these are acts of impunity that must stop in exchange for rule of law. It is therefore illegal and actually treasonous.
Joel Senyonyi, the spokesperson of the opposition National Platform, denied his party is organizing anything illegal. He instead called on the government to release party supporters incarcerated during or after the elections.
These people in the police and the military, especially the top officers, whenever they want to make some money, they will create a situation such as this. They know that Museveni is quick to release money when his throne is threatened. So they cook up things. Honorable Chagulani is planning this and so on. So that means Museveni releases money. Go buy tear gas, go buy this and so on. Which money they usually steal, those same top officers. So it's a hoax. It is planned by them. I mean, for us, whatever we do, we declare openly. We don't operate in hiding.
Chagulani, whose party won the highest number of seats in the parliament and who chose the leader of opposition in parliament, has been invited to attend Wednesday's swearing-in ceremony. But he has said he will not attend. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji, Kampala, Uganda.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, May 11th. Several Zambian opposition parties have announced the formation of an alliance with main opposition United Party for National Development, UPND, ahead of the upcoming August 12 general election. The opposition says the alliance will increase their prospects of posing a significant threat to the governing Patriotic Front, PF, party. But supporters of the ruling parties say the alliance is unlikely to give incumbent President Edgar Lungu sleepless nights. For more about the opposition alliance and its electoral prospects, VOA's Peter Clote reached Cornelius Mwitwa, spokesperson for Zambia's main opposition, UPND.
This alliance is significant to the extent that it was the most unlikely alliance to take place because it has featured the leading presidential contender within the ruling party, Patriotic Front, leaving his party to come and join the opposition in what many people thought should have been, what should have happened, because this is a leader, Yanai Kelvin Bariafuge, who represents a fresh breath of ideas which they thought that in the Patriotic Front may have been difficult to be implemented. So this is what the people want. This is the people's alliance.
Realistically, what are the chances of this alliance in defeating President Edgar Lungu and his Patriotic Front party, which appears to be the objective of this alliance?
This alliance is dubbed the Zambia we want, that Zambia must prosper. Now, the chances of this alliance being able to form the next government are grounded on the fact that this will not be the UPND alliance versus Patriotic Front. This will be the people of Zambia versus corruption, versus the rising national debt, the people of Zambia versus the rising cost of living, versus electoral violence. So it is a whole array of things that people of Zambia feel enough is enough. This government must be voted out. And this alliance only presents an opportunity, a platform through which to deliver the change the people want.
But some people are suggesting that there have been announced defections from the opposition. Prominent members from Chishimba Kambwili of the NDC, who initially was part of an alliance, resigned from his party, has joined the PF. Your own former spokesperson from the UPND has also joined. And some are saying they expect more defections, which they said could weaken the opposition significantly in the run-up to the elections. What are your thoughts?
As you would imagine, in a democracy, defections, movements are expected, but there are those that are significant and those that are a matter of convenience. If you talk about Chishimba Kambwili, you know that he's a convict right now. As you would imagine, under this current government, if you have charges that are criminal in nature and you want to buy your freedom, the best thing you can do is to join them. So as things stand now, the people who have left the opposition ranks, you aggregate them together. These are those who are now coming, people like those who have come from the Patriotic Front and those who will be joining in the next few days. You will see a clear distinction that those who are meritorious and add value to Zambia's politics are coming to aggregate their leadership around HH, and that is where the hope is for the country. I think the country now has accepted that to address the issue of the economy, they need the leadership skill set of HH, and that is what is giving us a lot of hope.
Cornelius Mwitwa is the spokesperson for Zambia's main opposition, United Party for National Development. He spoke with VOA's Peter Clote from the capital, Lusaka. A zircon mining deal in northern Senegal's Lampoule region needs more public input, says some activists in the area. The desert oasis site is a tourist attraction as well as important to farmers and fishermen. Mubarak Lowe, a senior fellow at the Policy Center of the New South, talked to Ricky Stryak about the community's concerns.
You need to have balance, to have these activities that employ thousands of people. You cannot just remove or push these people to move from this area, and because this has been done in Jago, an earlier zircon project. So this is what we are fearing, is that people could be disturbed in their activity and be forced to move just to have one company coming. And we don't say that we will never exploit the zircon, but just bringing out the zircon from the soil and exporting it, this is not in favor of the country, because what we need is transformation.
Can you tell me a little bit more about what happened in Jiogo?
In Jiogo, people have been moved from their house. They are in a city named Mehe. They are close to Mehe. So they have lost their activities there. There is no transformation. You just take the product, you polish and you send outside the world. And what is very funny, yesterday I met a lady who is working on ceramics. She told me that she is obliged to import zircon manufactured product for its activities. So we export the raw zircon, and the zircon is treated and then sent back to Senegal with much more value. So we think that this is not a good deal for the country.
What has the government reaction been to some of these demands so far?
Well, the government has given the right for this company to start producing, but we think that the government should reconsider this decision and at least ask them to transform the product, because if they do transformation, they can employ thousands of people, because the first project, Jiogo, they have promised to bring many employment, a lot of employment, but at the end of the day, this was not the case. They have promised to help the villages for water access, for school, for health facilities, etc. And assessment that has been made from an independent source has shown that this has not been done. So we don't want this to be reproduced in Lumpur. Me, I am from the region, and I think that this region needs better prospect transforming its resource in Senegal. This is what they need, and also balancing the activities, make sure that the production of zircon will not disturb the fishermen activities, the farmers activities, the touristic activities. So this is what Senegal needs, this is what the region needs, and this is what the population needs.
That was Mubarak Low, a senior fellow at the Policy Center of the New South. He was speaking with Ricky Stryat from Lumpur, northern Senegal. In much of Africa, women struggling to have children often face stigma and ridicule, including in Zimbabwe. To help women avoid community shame, a Zimbabwean doctor in 2017 reopened the country's first and only in vitro fertilization clinic. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
Since the clinic reopened in 2017, several years after its previous owner retired, IVF Zimbabwe says it has helped about 120 women have babies through in vitro fertilization. Dr. Sidin Farai, who runs the clinic with Dr. Tinovima Mhlanga, says some couples struggle to have children and turn to the wrong sources for help.
The most obstacle that is there hindering people from seeking assistance is lack of knowledge. Imagine how many people have stayed together for more than 1 year and they're still failing to conceive, but then they don't know where to go and get assistance. Normally people then tend to go to maybe traditional healers, faith healers, which are maybe cheap or easy to get, but without any good outcome from there.
Farai says he and Mhlanga are happy when they help couples reach their goal.
I think the value is really seen in the happiness and joy which we are bringing to subfertile couples in terms of assisting them to conceive and having a baby. The joy is real and something which is touching, personally affecting also us as individuals and clinicians. So basically assisting couples to conceive is helping maintaining marriages to continue, the unions to continue, and also bringing livelihood to people's lives.
One of those who have benefited from IVF Zimbabwe is a 30-year-old woman who is expecting to deliver next month. Her first marriage collapsed after 7 years of failing to conceive. As she narrates her ordeal with in-laws and community, she does not want to be identified.
The problem would always come back to us women. Maybe there's something that you did, or maybe there's you didn't go well. To be honest, there was a lot of negativity coming from the backstab.
Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
And that's it for this Tuesday, May 11th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butting, Washington, saying, have a lovely day.